Blog Talk Radio.
I'm terribly sorry, sir, but your credit card
your
has been
declined. Your unemployment benefits ran out two weeks ago.
What do you mean I'm overdrawn?
2 weeks ago.
I still have checks left.
Two weeks ago.
Too much month left over at the end of the money? Bad credit holding you back? Want to become a real estate investor but haven't won the lottery? Learn how to fix your credit. Get out of debt and build true financial independence with real estate in 2 hours a week. Tune in to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. She'll show you how, without winning the lottery or working 10 jobs. And here's your host, Heather Wagenhall.
Joining us this fabulous Saturday, May 8th, or in the spirit of the holiday that just passed, how about Happy Ocho de Cinco? Thanks so much for joining us today on this show. We have our Mother's Day edition. And happy Mother's Day, one day premature for all of you who are moms or moms-to-be or moms squared, that you're also a mother and a grandmother. And we're wishing all of you the very best, safe, happy holiday for this Mother's Day. And hope that your families treat you well. And regardless of what's going on financially, regardless of whether or not we like what we're going to get, we're going to practice our key that's coming up soon, no seasonal exceptions. We're going to be gracious recipients, even if it isn't what we wanted, even if, doggone it, our kids should have done better than that. And we're just going to take it as a grain of salt and be grateful for the fact that we were even remembered on this day. So, again, thanks for joining us. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, welcome to the broadcast. We broadcast Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio every Saturday at 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Every Tuesday at 6:30, we do Millionaire Nuts and Bolts from Unlock Your Wealth Radio so you can start your day the millionaire way. And on Wednesdays, we have a midweek update at 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time where you can get 30 minutes of tips, tricks, tools, and information that you can use about a given financial topic. And each week we explore some new avenue in financial services, money management, and general topics of interest that are current events. So as a result of the three broadcasts we bring you, the goal or purpose of our shows is that we talk about crisis management and financial wellness tools designed to help everyone, man, woman, and child alike, manage their finances and attitudes for the single purpose of achieving financial independence. And this week, like every other week, we have fabulous guests on our show. And we have all sorts of things to talk about. It's pretty amazing what's gone on this week. If you received a copy of our e-zine, then you know exactly what I'm talking about. And if you hadn't and would like to be a part of the show before the show goes on, all you have to do is simply send us an email to ezine@unlockyourwealth.com. That's E-Z-I-N-E @unlockyourwealth.com. And you too can receive all of the news, tips, tricks, tools, and information that you need to become financially independent for you and your family. Additionally, we also have our trivia question, which I'll get to in a minute. But this week on Minutes on Your Money, we are going to take a look at how to keep your nest egg intact after a job layoff. We're going to talk about some unemployment numbers. Our jobs report came in for last month. high-speed trading glitches and how much money you may have lost as a result, and what do you do when your financial advisor quits? Additionally, how about buying in bulk? We've got 15 things that you should avoid buying in bulk, and you'll be surprised at some of those on the list. I know that I was. And as a result of that, we never dwell on the negative here on this show. So we're also going to bring you the best bulk buying bargains. There's 10 of them that you should be thinking about. And also, on our Investor's Edge segment, what you need to know about finances and divorce. It's a terrible topic to have to address here on the show, I know, but the reality is that we're going to deal with a divorce, either directly in our own lives or someone we know is going to get divorced. And financially, it can be catastrophic if it's not handled properly. And so we have a certified divorce financial analyst coming on. And I had no idea that there was actually this designation to be earned or that people specialized in it. But I think we'll reveal through our interview some really important things that you need to be paying attention to if you're considering divorce. And on the flip side, if you're contemplating getting married, it would also be something of value for you because money is one of the hardest topics to talk about. We could talk about sex. We can talk about all kinds of familial indiscretions in our family tree. But when the subject of money comes up, for some reason, our lips just seal. So we want to be able to open up those areas of communication before you get married. So at least financially, that won't be one of the biggest reasons you get divorced because it is traditionally in the mainstream. And so if we can help to mitigate some of those issues, then you'll all be better served for that. Also, we have Blair Cherrier back in the saddle, sitting in, doing news by the numbers. And, of course, she is your chat room moderator. For those of you who are listening live from Blog Talk Radio, pop into the chat room. Say hi. If you've got a question, we may be able to answer it on air. So give Blair a chat. Say hello. Also, it's one of the ways that you can win when you play for the trivia question. And for those of you that are like, what, trivia question? Yes, you could win fabulous prizes if you answer our trivia question. We typically pull our trivia question from a previous show broadcast. That's why receiving the easy and ahead of time is so valuable, because those who subscribe get the trivia question before it goes on the air. So if you missed last week's episode or only were listening halfway, you'll have a chance to download and search for the answer before the trivia question is shown. Yes, for those of you joining us for the first time, in addition to listening live, we are also featured on iTunes and on our personal website, www.unlockyourwealth.com, where you can download previous broadcasts and use all of the tools available on our website for you. Now, on the midweek update, we talked about lame gifts to never give graduating seniors. All you have to do is name one of those gifts to win. I'll give you a hint. Number one, the first one we talked about was an empty picture frame. Always put a photograph in it. But there are several others, so I didn't throw it all away. If that's the only one you knew, then you're going to have to figure out a way to download the previous broadcast. You can win three ways. You can call in to win, and that's simply by dialing 1-718-508-9002, 1-718-508-9002. You can chat in to win. So if you pop into the chat room with Blair, you can tell her what you think the answer is, and you may be the lucky winner. If the trivia question goes unanswered on the show and you are listening to this as a download after the show's been aired live, you still may have a chance to win. So if you think that you can answer that trivia question, send us an email to trivia@unlockyourwealth.com. trivia@unlockyourwealth.com. And you too could possibly win in a share of prizes. We always have books and collateral materials from previous show guests. You could also win a copy of my book coming out. And if you win, I'll send you the ebook today for nada, gratis, free, no dinero. How fabulous would that be? And you can start reading Yes, You Can today before it's available physically in stores. Or you can have financial coaching. We have credit report review. We have a litany of other services that we offer through the Unlock Your Wealth Foundation that you are also eligible to win also. So the trivia question has some value. So if you are in pursuit of financial independence, you may just want to get a leg up on things by trying to answer the trivia question. So, okay. So how about Freddie Mac? He has noted that the first monthly drop in single-family loan delinquencies was here this past month. Delinquencies on single-family homes guaranteed by the agency fell 4.13% in March, down 0.7% from February. It's still up sharply from just 2.4% from a year earlier. By the way, we're in Minutes on Your Money. Forgot to introduce the segment. Shame on me. Industry watchers speculate that the March decline could mean more homeowners are beginning to pay off their mortgage loans instead of allowing properties to fall into foreclosure. The delinquency reduction is the first monthly decline reported by Freddie Mac since April of 2007. And that was before the whole turmoil started. The decrease was driven by a higher volume of completed loan modifications, as well as higher short sale volume during the month. Michael Cosgrove is a spokesman for Freddie Mac. Freddie Mac's multifamily delinquency rate also dropped slightly. In March, overdue multifamily mortgages were only 0.25%, which was down 0.01% from the month before. The aggregate unpaid principal balance of Freddie Mac's mortgage-related investments portfolios was $753 billion, as in billion with a B, as in boy, is that a lot of money, at the end of March, from $732 in February. So the company explained this growth was largely related to purchases of loans from mortgage-backed securities holders, which began in February, when the agency announced it would buy back more than $71 billion in delinquent loans from mortgage pools it sold off to those investors. So I'm applauding Freddie Mac for attempting to right the ship. It is tough to get these loan modifications done. They're doing they're approving the wrong people that are going back into default. And as a result, if they don't reduce the interest rate or lower the payment or waive some of that principal balance, I think we're going to still see some more strategic defaults. I don't personally believe we're out of the woods yet. And that's just me. But how about keeping your nest egg intact after a layoff? It might seem to be impossible, but Emily Brandon of U.S. News and World Report shares that as stressful as an unexpected job loss is, the other coming headache is what do you do about that 401k? Without careful attention, there are plenty of taxes and penalties that could shrink your existing retirement account balance. Here she shares some tips to keep your retirement stash intact when your job is eliminated. First, you want to find out if you are vested. All the money that you deposit in a 401k still belongs to you after a layoff, but you can only keep a portion of your employer's contributions if they are vested, which means they matched or did something in that way. Only about one-third of 401k plans provide immediate vesting in 2008, which means employees can keep a 401k match when it is deposited, according to a profit share 401k Council of America survey. Other retirements may require you to be with the company for several years, before you can actually keep any of your employer match or gradually increase the percentage you may keep based on your tenure. So you need to find out if your employer contributions are vested immediately or if there's some sort of program, because you're going to end up with less than what you think if you're not vested and your termination comes at a time where you haven't made or met those vesting requirements. Make your move is the next thing that she suggests. After you figure out if you're vested or not, you have several options to maintain tax-deferred benefits of your 401k when you leave a job. You can keep the money in your old employer's plan, roll it into another tax-deferred account such as an IRA, or transfer your balance into a new 401k when you land at your next position. Transferring your old 401k balance to an IRA makes sense when the IRA offers better investment choices and lower expenses than your old 401k plan. However, you may want to leave your 401k plan with your former employer if the company has negotiated low investment fees on behalf of employees. David Loper, author of Stop the Retirement Ripoff, How to Avoid Hidden Fees and Keep More of Your Money, says that savers should aim to pay 0.75% less in annual fees. So you need to make that decision up front. Number three, avoid transfer penalties. If you decide to move your retirement savings, have your former employer directly transfer the money into an IRA or your new employer's retirement plan, and have your checks made out to the institution where it is going instead of the check being made out to you. IRA expert Ed Slott, founder of IRAhelp.com and author of Stay Rich for Life, Growing and Protecting Your Money in Turbulent Times, when a check for the balance is made out to the worker, the company will withhold 20% for income taxes. Employees have 60 days to deposit that cash in a new tax-deferred investment account before Uncle Sam keeps that 20% for good. And the worker may also be responsible for additional taxes. So if you're under 55, you will also, in addition to that 20%, have a 10% early withdrawal fee. So how about losing 30% of your bucks just to have cash now? Bad idea. Bad. You have enjoyed the power of compounding interest. You need to allow the rule of 72 to continue on your path so you can retire a millionaire. If you roll the whole nest egg into an IRA, your company will make the checkout directly, and then you bypass all of that, and 100% of your proceeds go there. Next, you have to consider your age. IRA withdrawals before 59.5 result in a 10% early withdrawal penalty. Retirees can take penalty-free withdrawals at age 55, though. But if you need that money at age 57, you might want to leave it in the plan. Says Kathleen Campbell of Campbell Financial Partners, because, again, it may benefit you better later. Leave employer stock behind. The stock of a company you work for gets special tax treatment when it is held in an employer-sponsored 401k. If you roll over the stock to an IRA deal, the deal is off forever. So when you withdraw a company's stock at the original cost of the shares will be taxed as ordinary income, but the appreciation of the stock is not taxed until you sell it. Then it is taxed at the long-term cap gains rate of 15%. If your company stock is rolled over to an IRA, appreciation is taxed at the typically higher ordinary income tax in the IRA, which could be up to 35%. So separate those puppies out when it comes to transferring and rolling over. And think before you cash out. Almost half of laid-off workers who left their job in 08 cashed out their 401Ks. According to a Hewlett Associates study, 401K participants who terminated employment. But early withdrawals come with a significant cost. A worker with a $5,000 401K balance in the 20% tax bracket would just receive $3,500 after taxes and penalties. And if there's any way you can avoid touching that money, you should. I mean, what's $5,000 going to do? Most of the time, when you're in trouble, or if you're being laid off and you've been flying by the seat of your pants, $5,000 isn't solving your woes. Leave it alone and roll it over if you're going to do anything. Just leave it alone and roll it over. And that's all from Emily Brandon from U.S. News and World Report, by the way. April jobs report has had their biggest gain since 2006, and even though unemployment is up. And I think that Blair is going to probably talk a little bit more about that. But there was a gain of just under 300,000 jobs in this month, up from 230,000 added in March. And it was the largest number of jobs added, 60,000 of them, in the workforce since March of 06. We'll have more on that from Blair during News by the Numbers. But are you an electronic trader? The New York Times is reporting that high-speed trading glitches cost investors billion with a B, as in, boy, is that a lot of money. The glitch that sent markets tumbling on Thursday was years in the making, driven by the rise of computers that transformed stock trading more in the last 20 years than in the previous 200. The old system of floor traders matching buyers and sellers has been replaced by machines that process trades automatically, speeding the flow of buy and sell orders, but also sometimes facilitating the kinds of unexplained volatility that roiled the markets on Thursday. Now, James Engel from Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business finance professor says that we have a market that responds in milliseconds, but the humans monitoring respond in minutes. And unfortunately, billions of dollars of damage can occur in the meantime. In recent years, what is known as high-frequency trading, which is rapid computerized buying and selling, it's taken off and now accounts for half to three-quarters of actual daily trading volume. At the same time, new electronic exchanges have taken over much of the volume that used to be handled by the New York Stock Exchange. In fact, more than 60% of trading in stocks listed on the NYSE takes place on other computerized exchanges. So many questions were left unanswered even hours after the end of the trading day. Who or what was the culprit? Why did markets spin out of control so rapidly? And what needs to be done to prevent this from happening again? The NASDAQ exchange says that it would cancel trades that move shares more than 60% up or down at 2:40 p.m. when stocks like Accenture plummeted to a penny a share for seemingly no reason. Exelon, the utility operator, fell to a hundredth of a penny from $44. Procter & Gamble, a big component of the Dow Industrials average, dived 37% for a brief time before rebounding. And the move by Procter alone pushed down the Dow by more than 150 points, providing cause for a broader alarm among investors, which followed panic selling. You can't take the human element out of so many things. Computers can only do so much. And that's just my personal editorial embellishment there. The SEC and the Commodities Futures Trading Commission said that they were examining the cause of the unusual trading activity. Mary Shapiro, the chief of the SEC, and Gary Gensler, the head of the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, held conference calls with overseers of the exchanges who were reviewing trading tapes from the day. One official said they identified a huge, anomalous, unexplained surge in selling. It looks like in Chicago at about 2:45 p.m. The source remained unknown, but that jolt apparently set off trading based on computer algorithms, which in turn rippled across all indexes and spiraled out of control. How the markets managed to snap back remained a question Thursday night. The near instantaneous swings left brokers dumbfounded. Dermot W. McClancy, who runs a New York Stock Exchange brokerage, said Thursday that it was one of the five worst days he's seen in the 24 years in the business. When the market dropped across all indexes in a matter of minutes, customers were calling him nonstop. They're calling saying, is there something I'm missing? Is there somebody valuing these securities at this level? Is there some news in the marketplace I'm not aware of? And the answer is that it all started with an apparent error, infuriated Mr. Clancy. There are so many things wrong with what happened today. He said that the market was never down 1,000 points. Procter & Gamble should have never traded at $39. But a lot of people lost money as if the prices were meant to drop. This is an injustice to the public. The whole trading system, McClancy says, went into what brokers call slow mode. When the large sell order came in, the market makers for each of those stocks were overwhelmed trying to sell that order, and they could not take other orders. It was sort of like a traffic jam on the highway, and it spread to create traffic jams on other highways. Suddenly, traders started to distrust what they were seeing, and there was no pricing mechanism, Clancy says. There was nothing. No one knew what anything was worth. You didn't know where to buy a stock or sell a stock, and you didn't know if the market was down $500 or $1,000. So hopefully you weren't beset with any of those losses, but we have to rethink how convenient computers are, but what are the limitations we have on them when they're in our lives? How about what do you do when your advisor quits? When you've been fortunate enough to find a financial advisor you trust, one who gives you good advice that is in your best interest, you have a solid financial plan in place, and everything is going smoothly despite the ups and downs of the stocks and bond markets. Your advisor knows you and your financial situation so well that you hardly have to do anything. And then the worst happens. He or she decides to quit. By Motley Fool, from May 6th, maybe retirement has beckoned long enough. Perhaps the pressures of working for a high-powered financial institution have become too great. It's even possible that your advisor may have been pushed out by an employer because of his or her reluctance to embrace new profit-centric philosophies. Whatever the reason, you need to know how to protect yourself. The hard sell is whether your advisor works for a big Wall Street brokerage like Morgan Stanley or with a small local firm, you're likely to get invited to meet with the new advisor who is assuming responsibility for your account. You may meet that new advisor one-on-one or with your current advisor. For many people, the initial meeting is extremely uncomfortable. In some ways, it feels as though you're cheating with someone with whom you have a close relationship with. So you'll want to ask your current advisor for an opinion on the prospective new advisor. While you may get the same frank, open answers you've gotten in the past, you should understand that your advisor is often in an awkward position. Some brokerage firms tie retirement compensation and other benefits to whether or not the retiring advisor's clients stay with the firm. Therefore, your advisor may have a financial incentive for you to stay put. So take heed when consulting them for their advice. New strategy or new commission. However, your new advisor may completely have different ideas about how you should invest to reach your financial goals. Conservative investors with fixed income securities and stable blue chip stocks may suddenly get pitched aggressive investments like hedge funds and other unfamiliar alternatives. Even though you may only make a small number of transactions in a given year, you may find yourself offered products such as unified managed accounts, which purport to give you access to investments that only the wealthy investors can make, but which also carry significant annual fees, regardless of your level of trading activity, which could chew up any profits you might have. And remember, if you haven't traded a whole bunch, or whatever your current trading volume is, if someone's pressuring you to go start trading again or in different stuff that you're not comfortable with or don't understand, that's called churning, and that is a crime. So you need to be well aware of what's going on with your account and monitor it daily if you're nervous, especially if you're a high-volume trader and you trade daily. You know, go online and look at your reports to make sure that what you say is really what's happening. And if you have any issues, you go straight to management and then maybe find another place to invest. Get a second opinion. If you're not sure whether your new advisor is doing the right thing for you, consider having another financial professional look at whatever new strategies or products you've been offered. Just as you wouldn't decide on having a life-threatening surgical procedure without considering all of your options and getting a second opinion, you shouldn't consent to a radical change in your investment without knowing all the facts. And you may want to try an investment advisor from a completely different firm. That's what I would recommend, because how do you know that someone else in the firm isn't going to be singing the same song? If it's a company-wide mantra, you might be having a problem. Questions you'll want to ask is how the cost of the proposed strategy compared with your current strategy. Will there be any tax ramifications to switching to the new strategy? And how well the proposed investments have performed in relation to similar investments offered by other institutions, and whether or not the new strategy will be riskier than your current strategy. Make sure that you ask these questions and ask until you get answers you like or are comfortable with. And if not, then you need to think about moving your money somewhere else. So, 15 things not to buy in bulk. Sometimes it's smart and even thrifty to resist the lure of a deal, contrary to popular belief. But you may end up spending less in the long run if you do buy some items in smaller quantities. Seth Fiegerman of Main Street says the frugal part of her cringes, cringes to admit to this, but not all things are great to buy in bulk. Here are some things you should know when considering what you should buy and shouldn't buy in bulk. So you should not buy brown rice. We all know that it is usually not smart to buy perishable products like eggs or milk in bulk, but there are plenty of other things out there that people tend to store indefinitely without realizing they expire within 6 months to a year. Case in point, brown rice. In general, we tend to think of rice as something that lasts and lasts, but brown rice, which happens to be healthier for you, has a much shorter shelf life because it has naturally more oil. Buy it in moderation and store it in a refrigerator if you plan on keeping it a long time. It'll keep the oil portion from going rancid. Number two, candy. One key rule of buying in bulk is that you should be aware of purchasing guilty pleasures like candy and other junk food. Otherwise, bulk buying can turn into bulk eating. One consumer put it well on savingadvice.com. If I go to my local store and I buy two candy bars for $1 a piece, I spend $2 and they will last a week. I buy a box at Costco of 24 candy bars for $12 and they'll still be gone in a week. Even though the unit price is less, I end up spending more because I'm porking out when I shouldn't be. Here's a couple of interesting ones: paper, towels, and toilet paper. While it may sound like a good idea at first because they're not perishable, they do tend to cost less when you buy them in bulk. But according to Joshua Thomas, a spokesman for Target, says there's the downside of buying rolls and rolls of paper towels and toilet paper. They may be more evergreen, but before you buy them in bulk, you need to think about how much space you have. Could you be taking up other space for storage? And last, you know, bulk items that are light on your wallet can weigh down heavy in your life in other ways. Toilet paper is the same thing. You don't want to run out, but you don't want to open the cabinet and have it all fall out upon you. Nuts, number five. No, we're not going, and we probably shouldn't be buying. In general, you should try to avoid buying nuts in bulk unless you're the kind of person who munches on them throughout the day. They may be more affordable in bulk, but nuts usually expire within 2 months. And again, the high fat content in nuts, particularly peanuts, pecans, and walnuts, cause them to go rancid rather quickly. Alejandro Ramos is a home cooking expert and creator of the website Always Order Dessert. If you must buy them in large quantities, remember that roasted nuts last longer than raw ones, and shelled ones last the longest. Light, heat, and moisture also affect the quality and have a tendency to absorb smells, so always store nuts in the fridge or freezer. This also goes for seeds and seed-like nuts, like sesame seeds, flax seeds, and pine nuts. Now, mayonnaise and other condiments. And, oh, I could just throttle my husband for these. Avoid buying these condiments in bulk like mayo, ketchup, and salad dressing unless you'll be using them right away or it's for a large party or event, because they only last 6 months, and they take much longer to get through than you'd expect because you're only using like a tablespoon or two at a time. So watch that, buying in bulk. Also, vitamins and nutritional supplements. Even buying stuff that's good for you may end up being a bad investment. Several consumers wrote to Main Street about why it's not worth buying vitamins and other supplements because they expire. And you're probably going to get hit with some boredom of drinking the same flavored protein shake every day. Number eight, diapers. Neural also urges parents to refrain from buying diapers in bulk because babies grow. Bleach is another item that you might be inclined to buy in bulk, but it goes bad over time. It only has a shelf life of 6 months, and it starts to degrade. Number 10, spices. You think it's a good idea to buy them in bulk because you want to pretend like you're a real chef, but they expire too. They lose their potency, more important than just expire. In 6 months to a year, their flavor has virtually evaporated. Number 11, bread. Unless you like stale, hard bread, don't buy it in bulk. Tilapia is also another one not to buy in bulk. Most people seem to think that, you know, specifically you can buy fish like tilapia in bulk, especially the farmer's variety, and that you can actually get it cheaper if you go shop around to other stores, that buying that in bulk actually isn't a value. Eggs, also, they go bad. Frozen foods and meat seem like a great deal, but, you know, you got to weigh the savings against the fact that you won't be able to put anything else in there either, and how fast are you going to consume it. And cereal, don't let your kids sucker you into buying a ton of Lucky Charms or Cocoa Puffs because they happen to love it at the moment. Kids are fickle, their tastes change, and they'll get bored with the same thing over and over. And what you want to be careful of is, again, stuff expires, and if they find one of the five flavors you bought today, and they might not they might not go back to it, and before you know it, it's expired. So what can you buy in bulk that's of value? How about number one, cooking oil? Number two, toothbrushes. Number three, antiseptic wipes. Number five, certain vitamins will last. Number six, soup. Number seven, dog food. Number eight, beer. Number nine, tuna. And a couple of others, if you're buying in bulk, they qualify these statements because it was just on the don't buy in bulk. You're going to buy diapers. Buy ones that your child is going to grow into as opposed to what they're currently wearing now. And that would be helpful. And that's your list. Now, we have a very exciting guest on here shortly for Investor's Edge. But first, let's hear a word from our sponsors, and we'll be right back with more Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio coming up right after this.
Hi, I'm Tony Stewart, driver of the number 14 Office Depot Old Spice Chevrolet, and you're listening to Heather Wagenhall's on Unlock Your Wealth Radio.
Has your cell phone or iPod ever run out of battery before? Maybe you're somewhere without power, like fishing, camping, or the beach. Well, now you can have all the power you need. The K3 Charger by Kinesis Industries uses wind and sun to charge your devices anytime, day or night. Use the wind and sun to store up charging power or charge your device right now on the spot. Available now for $99.95 at www.kinesisindustries.com. That's Kinesis, K-I-N-E-S-I-S industries.com.
Hi, this is Melanie, and I'm part of Two for the Road USA. I'm the X from Boomer and X. I've been test driving cars for several years, but in the last 18 months, I found it difficult to get in and out of the test vehicles. I kept complaining the manufacturers didn't make the seats large enough until I realized it was me who was too large at 220 pounds. Thanks to the Diradori weight loss program, I lost 50 pounds. The Diradori program is physician-supervised, non-surgical, safe, and effective, and you can lose up to 5 to 10 pounds the first week and 15 to 20 in a month. I did. It controls hunger and trains your body to burn fat, all on an easy-to-follow regimen of exercise, hydration, and delicious healthy eating. It is a three-phase program combining medication, nutrition, and exercise. This is an affordable program with counselors available at any time. I went from a size 20 to a size 10 in 7 months, and I feel like a different person. Check out my photos on twofortheroadusa.com. Click on Watch Melanie Lose Weight on Diradori. Call Diradori now at 480-661-9662.
Back to the broadcast, everyone. You are listening to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. It's time for our Investor's Edge segment. And I don't think anybody's won the trivia question yet. So, again, we talked about worst grad gifts ever. So if you think that you have the answer, remember, call in, chat in, or email in to win. Now, this week's Investor's Edge guest has a truly unique and varied background. She has been involved in many careers. She is a breast cancer and multiple sclerosis survivor. She is the treasurer on the board of directors for visionsanew.org. It's one of the premier women's divorce support organizations in the country, with support groups and weekend divorce school retreats that support, guide, empower, and encourage women when they choose divorce. She is also a certified divorce financial analyst. She is one of the co-authors of Yes, You Can, the book that I have participated in. And she always works to strive to help her clients divorce their spouse and not their money. So we should have an interesting conversation with Lisa today. Welcome to the broadcast, Lisa. Thanks so much for being a part of the broadcast today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
I'm so excited to have you on as a guest because this has been a recurrent theme I saw for so long when I was underwriting mortgages. And even if the divorce decree says one thing, you've got your credit report and underwriters and, you know, your lenders telling you other things. And this was always a serious problem for. But I know that there are other financial issues surrounding divorce and money, and you're my first guest that I've had on that is actually a certified divorce financial analyst. And so I'm very excited to have you on the broadcast. Can you tell folks a little bit about what it means to be a certified divorce financial analyst?
Yes, I can, and you bring up some great points there. I'd love to address that, but first I'll tell you that as a certified divorce financial analyst, what we do is look at the financial matters in divorce. So many times when people are getting divorced, they think it's all about the legal aspects. You know, you always hear people talking about their attorneys, but what they don't realize is that the finances of divorce are just as important, maybe even more important, because they're going to be left with the financial ramifications long after the legal aspects are said and done. And so we can work with people in a variety of ways. Some of us work with individuals pre-divorce. We get a financial plan in place and then, you know, work that through the divorce process. Sometimes we work with couples as a neutral. Maybe they've gone to a mediator and they just have some issues that they want to work out on the finances. They want to make sure they're not falling into tax traps and other issues that come up in divorce. There's a lot of quirks in the finances of divorce. And sometimes we work through an attorney to supplement their strategies and make sure that there are no other pitfalls that people can fall into. So we come at it from a variety of angles, depending on the individual, but, you know, we're out here making sure that people get their fair share with their spouse, with their attorney, and with Uncle Sam.
Yeah, there's a lot of different categories that need to be covered. Do you do anything on the pre-nuptial side of things? Do people come to you for that, or is it usually too late?
Well, that's an interesting thought. I personally have not had people come to me for prenuptial work, but, you know, that might not be a bad idea. I think probably just consulting with a good financial advisor overall would at least be in order, making sure that, you know, whatever you have, if you are setting up a prenuptial, then you probably have some separate assets to protect. Separate meaning that they belong to that individual before they got married, and in a prenup, you know, we're talking premarital here, and they want to protect that in the event of a divorce. So, you know, it is potential that you could consult with a certified divorce financial analyst along with an attorney. Not a bad idea at all.
I know that people are in decidedly different camps when it comes to prenups. They're either totally for them or totally against them. And on both sides of the fence, I would say that both camps don't understand the value of a prenup, or they misunderstand what the value of a prenup is, and that's why they're so either strongly for or against them, because they work both ways. And I don't think people realize that. And, you know, and I've had comments, you know, divorce is something that you have to be rational about, especially if you have children and specific financial needs, either for the children or yourself, or you have assets that maybe got commingled, or you have money that was made while the two of you were together versus, you know, coming together with big assets beforehand. And then you deal with all of this frustration and hurt and anger usually when people go through divorce, that they can't see the forest for the trees sometimes. The emotions get the best of us, and both parties would benefit from some sort of counseling. If somebody's considering a divorce, what's the first thing that they need to do? If someone comes to you and says, I'm thinking about divorce, I have or I have not talked about it yet, but I've got some financial ramifications, what do people need to know when going through divorce?
Well, I want to address what you said. It's definitely an emotional time. That goes without saying. But, you know, taking the emotions out of it is the role of a CDFA, or Certified Divorce Financial Analyst, because we can look at it without that emotional drain that clouds our thinking. And so we can be the voice of reason for you when you're not thinking clearly. A lot of people do come to me and say, you know, I'm thinking about it. I'm not sure I want to file for divorce, but I am considering it. What do I need to do? What do I need to consider? What do I need to gather? Where do I begin? And so, you know, honestly, the best thing to do is consult with someone if you're having those thoughts. I like to send people to a marriage counselor, first of all, because I'm not an advocate for divorce. I like to know that my clients have given it every effort, whether they go by themselves or they convince a spouse to go with them, so that there's no regrets afterwards of maybe we could have tried a little harder. That being said, if they've done that or they're sure that this is what they want to do, then I will suggest that, first off, you start gathering every single document that has to pertains to your financial life and making copies. And I would suggest that you make at least two copies, because if you're going to be working with an attorney in the future, you're going to need a set for them, and you're also going to need a set for your financial advisor, and you may even need to make a third set, one for yourself and one to keep at the household, you know, for your spouse if you're going to work it out amicably, or one to keep off site. If it doesn't look like it's going to go that way. Sometimes you can put it on a thumb drive, something like that. But you want to gather those documents, because once divorce becomes imminent, what we see a lot of times is that those documents disappear. And it can be very difficult to get those documents. And without them, you really have no means to prove what you're asserting that you own or you owe. And so gather the documents, make the copies, get them off-site. Usually your financial advisor will give you a list of those, but it's going to be everything from your bank statements, your investment accounts, real estate that you've purchased, everything from the initial mortgage applications to the closing documents to the deed, anything having to do with retirement or pension plans, pull your credit report, Social Security statements, just anything and everything you can think of. You also want to start looking at a budget. You know, it is definitely cheaper for two to live than one, so you have to consider that. You can't just take your mortgage payment and cut it in half unless you're seriously going to cut your lifestyle in half. So, you know, we work at getting a realistic picture of what does the future look like. So it's a, in the beginning, it's a lot of gathering to get the numbers that we need to get a clear snapshot of where are you today and what is your future going to look like. I happen to use a very powerful divorce software, and clients can go in and input their data, and then we can start to create scenarios and reports going out as far as 30 years so we can really get a handle on what does this look like. One of the other considerations that they really need to make in the beginning is, how do they envision their divorce to look? Because a lot of people don't realize they have options. They think of divorce and they think of attorney. And this can be dangerous. It can be very dangerous because if you are in an emotional state where you just run out and hire an attorney because your neighbor recommended that one, or you pull them out of the phone book, whatever the case may be, you go in, you're distraught, they may say a few things that sound good to you, and you retain them, you hire their services. Well, if you pick the wrong kind of attorney, and by that I mean someone who is not in the same mindset of you, they could potentially fan the flames. And what that means is that maybe you could have worked things out with your spouse through mediation. I'm going to explain that in a minute. Maybe you wouldn't have gone at it in the manner that this attorney may have. You need to make sure that their styles are in sync with the kind of divorce that you're going to have. And a lot of people don't realize the questions to ask. By the way, I have a free list of 37 questions to ask an attorney before you sign on their dotted line. And I will give you that site. It's SaveMoneyInDivorce.com, and people can download that free list of questions. But it's very important that you know what to ask, because if the wrong kind of attorney gets into your life, they can wreak havoc. You remember here, if you have children, you're going to be connected throughout your life. Even after your children are grown and gone, there will be grandchildren. You don't want your divorce to go the wrong way, if at all possible. And if they're fanning the flames between you and your spouse, or between them and your spouse's attorney, the fees keep going up and up and up. I've seen people spend what assets they had in attorney's fees and have nothing left to fight over. So there has to be a common sense approach in looking at which way should we go. So some of the options might be to start with a CDFA and see where you stand. I have quite a few couples that come to me and say, we want to work out the numbers ourselves. Well, once they've worked that out, and if they can get a parenting plan, if they have children, get a parenting plan in place, then they can file uncontested. There's nothing left to fight about. So all they need an attorney to do is draw up the papers. Sometimes they need someone to help them a little bit more. Maybe they go to a mediator. A mediator is a neutral person who helps them work through the issues. And again, I might come in as a financial neutral, also neutral to just help steer them around potential traps and problems. And that's a great way to go, very cost effective. There's also collaborative divorce. It's a team concept. You've got coaches. Each side has a coach and an attorney. There's a financial neutral and a child specialist if you need that. But collaborative divorce, everybody agrees up front, we're not going to court. We're going to work this thing through, and if we don't, then we have to start all over again with new counsel, new advisors. No one can work with them again. So it can be costly if that doesn't work out. The next approach would be cooperative divorce. similar to collaborative with the team concept, but you do leave open the door for going to court. And then again, we talk about traditional litigated divorce where, you know, things can get ugly pretty quickly if you've got the wrong kind of attorney. Just one. It only takes one on either side. So, you know, find out your options and your game plan up front. If you need a hardball attorney, then that's what you look for. But if you're not interested in that type of divorce, then, you know, look for a different kind as well. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And so you've got maybe some attorneys that are willing to refer you that are volume attorneys because everything is so amicable, and then you've got others that probably don't want you guys at the mix because they want to chew up all the fees themselves.
Oh, absolutely.
All the money that's there in fees. Outside of child custody, I can't imagine, you know, stuff being that important. I would imagine what money is left between the two would be what people would go to war over. So the value that you can bring to the table with these different scenarios sounds very, very interesting. What can people do to protect themselves along the way? Let's say, you know, we've got newlyweds listening to the show and they're like, oh my gosh, what do I need to know as I'm going along to maybe preserve the harmony in my marriage? Because what's the ratio now of or the percentage of financial issues that cause divorce? Isn't it like the number one reason why people get divorced now?
Depends on which study you look at, but it's definitely among the top three, and communication problems are up there as well. So I would say that starting with a strong foundation, you know, you want to start your marriage off by keeping the lines of communication open before you get married. And that means sitting down with your spouse-to-be and saying, you know, let's talk about money. And people are uncomfortable with this, but it's really important because you may discover that you each have different styles. One may be a hoarder and the other one may be a spender. You may have different beliefs about money. Some people are very charitable. Other people, you know, are not so. Some people are driven to work hard through their career and say, I'm going to give it 80 hours a week. And I've had other spouses say to me, you know, if I'd have known that up front that they were going to be so married to their career to make this money, I probably wouldn't have married this person to begin with. So what are some of the goals that they have financially in life? Make sure that those are in sync. And these are things that we don't talk about in many cases. I would love to see people have to take a premarital money class and communication styles before they can get a marriage license. I think we could cut down on these 50% marriage rates. And by the way, that's 50% of first marriages fail. When it comes to second marriages, it goes up to 60% fail, and third marriages 70% fail. So, you know, not getting this right the first time.
I'm my husband's fourth marriage. What does that mean for him? Your statistics are getting gruesome for me.
I'm not going there. Getting the right person can change all of that, you know.
Yeah, well, I'm on number two with him, but he's on number four with me.
Well, you know, yeah. There's people that beat those odds. And, you know, just making sure, like I said, that you talk about your money styles, and you're talking money all the time here, so you've got a good leg up. You know, I encourage people to do this before they get married. Get these things out. You know, what do you think about money? What do you think about lifestyle? Let's talk about religion. Let's talk about politics. People fall in love. They're under the ether, and they don't see these things. They don't want to talk about them. They don't want to see the flaws, and that's a lot of times what leads to divorce on the other end. So, and it's not just a one-time conversation. This has got to be ongoing throughout the marriage. I'm married with my husband for 32 years here, and, you know, it's not easy. It's a process. You have ebbs and flows, but it's constantly keeping the lines of communication open that I think has been our strong points. So that's just a little tip that I offer up from a long-range perspective. So even if you have not been that way all along, you've been married for a while, it's never too late. If you find that you just don't know how to open that line of communication, find a good therapist or look for a class. There's all kinds of things out there. So, you know, it's never too late to start the dialogue. But that's what you, for newlyweds, for those who are just beginning, start with a strong foundation. Just like anything you want to build in life, a marriage is a building, you know, and you, any kind of building needs a good foundation under it or it will crumble. So that's just my first word of advice.
Because I think about, we'll talk about the craziest sexual things with people. Whether they're a stranger or a spouse or future spouse or potential spouse. But when it comes to money, we clam up. And I think of it like Eckhart Tolle says that we fall in love and we get married. When this person enhances our own personal life story, they're good for us. And then when the rose-colored glasses come off and we start kind of seeing who they are and they don't kind of enhance our life story, our own life story, that's when we get divorced and we go look for somebody else that enhances our life story. Half of that can be cured by just opening up that conversation about money, because whether you have it or not, the conversation is still going to be strained in some way. Mm-hmm. And people think, well, we don't have any money, why should we talk about it? And that's precisely when, because what are you going to do when you have it?
Exactly.
At some point, you accumulate wealth, whether it's through your employer-defined pension plan, whether you are a prodigious saver, whether you hit the lottery. At some point, you are going to have money, and you need to discuss how that's handled. And if you don't have money and are chronically without it, that's also a reason to have a discussion.
Absolutely.
Because why are we not accumulating money? If there's two of us, we should have more than double the earning power, because we are greater, you know, than the sum of our parts. And so 1 + 1 equals more than two. And if you have more than two people making a contribution, there should be even more left over, not less.
Absolutely.
And that needs to be addressed as well. And if somebody doesn't, I think about how accurate an assessment you made by saying, you know, what is your charitable giving style? What is your thoughts on spending? What is your thoughts on earning? You know, do you want to make money at all costs? I mean, am I never going to see you? I mean, how is this going to play out? Because, you know, we kind of put on this facade depending on how long you date before you get married. And sometimes people get all the way through the altar, and then they start finding out stuff like after the honeymoon is over. And you're like, oh, wow, really? That's how you felt? And it should occur to people to ask those questions up front. You know, just like you would, you know, well, what's your favorite color and what do you like to do? And you used to say, how do you feel about money?
Exactly.
What's your position on managing it? What's your position on spending it?
Well, one other thing I'd like to add in there is, I encourage people, if they're getting married, they should have an STD test, you know. Let's get it out on the table. Let's see, you know, that we're not bringing anything into this marriage that wouldn't be favorable for either side. While you're at it, pull your credit reports and sit down and go over those. If there's issues, it's time to find out about it beforehand. I had a woman recently who was going through her third divorce, and as she was explaining, the reason behind each of the divorces was that she was trying to fix each husband's spending issues. Husband number three had bankruptcy issues, but she thought she could fix him. And so she took on all of the debt because he couldn't get any debt in his name because he had bankruptcy issues. And now she was leaving the marriage with a lot of debt that she didn't have when she came into it. And so, you know, people can make mistakes. I'm not saying if your spouse-to-be has had credit problems that, you know, you don't marry them. But you want to delve in and find out what caused it. and how do we prevent it from happening again? Maybe it was an illness. Maybe they lost a job. You know, there's reasons that these things happen. But you need to get it out up front. You need to set expectations for what each of you want the marriage to look like moving forward. And learn these things in the beginning. Because if you realize this isn't what I had in mind, better before the marriage than after when you're already in it and now you got issues. So that kind of leads me to my next point, which is to keep your separate property separate. I think I mentioned that in the beginning of the call. But, you know, people come into a marriage and a lot of times it's what's mine is yours and yours is mine, and they just kind of throw everything in the marital pot. And then it doesn't work out, and they're going, well, wait a minute. You know, I brought in my inheritance from Aunt Sue, but you didn't contribute this or that, and I want that now. Well, you know, depending on where you live in the country, most states will say once commingled, it's now marital funds, and that means it gets split with your spouse or soon-to-be ex. So if you've got separate property, whether it's funds in a bank account, whether it's a trust account, a piece of property that's in your name only, keep it that way. Honey, I love you, but this is mine, and to keep this clean, it's always going to stay mine. And that may go to the prenup that you were talking about earlier as well. But you want to keep that separate property separate. Now, different rules have different states have different rules about the growth of those assets during the marriage, whether they're marital or separate, the rental income on investment property, all kinds of stuff. So you need to work with somebody who is wise to the matters of your state. But understand that the way that you prevent the biggest issues are to keep your separate property separate. So once they're commingled, it's usually a done deal in many cases. So the other thing is I recommend that spouses keep money in their own name regardless. Even if they had nothing coming into the marriage, now they're each working, making money, have a separate bank account. Use a joint account to pay your expenses. But you know what? If you talk about it up front and say, look, you know, I want to have a little pot of money that if I want to go buy myself an outfit or I want to go take a little trip, that I can pull upon my own funds and do that and not feel like I'm causing a problem in the marriage. Set these things, expectations up front, and never be at the mercy of someone else for access to your own money. So a lot of times I see women especially come to me and say, well, he took all the joint funds and I have no access to the money. Now you're coming from a danger place in trying to move forward in a divorce. You've got no cash to live on. You've got no money to hire financial or legal advisors. And that really is a danger zone. It doesn't come from a place of empowerment, which is where you want to be. So I recommend that people, for a lot of reasons, have their own separate accounts. Your separate property is either something that you came into the marriage with and kept separate in your name, or something that you received during the marriage and kept separate in your name, such as a gift or inheritance or something to that nature. However, just because you each have separate bank accounts, the reason that I said that is so that you have access to your own money. Those accounts, if they were funded during the marriage, if there were funds that you created either through market forces or wages or earnings or whatever, if the growth on those was during the marriage because of marital efforts, even if it's just one side or the other, even if they're in separate names, they are marital assets. Just because I have this quite frequently. Here in Georgia, you know, people will say, well, it's the accounts in his name or the accounts in her name. But those accounts are from the time during the marriage. So it really doesn't matter the title on them in our state. It's the fact that they were created and grew during the time of the marriage.
You are correct. I mean, commingled funds, you know, the minute, you know, if you take those proceeds that you received from an inheritance and you drop it into a joint account, you're done. Co-mingled,
mm-hmm.
It's toast. And so somebody else has, you know, a legal right to a portion of that. What that portion is, maybe left up to a judge. But to not have to go through that makes sense to set things up in that way. You talk about minding your money matters.
Yes.
And a lot of people think life is going to go on forever, and you never know. I always say, I never know when I'm going to step off that curb and that Mack truck's going to snuff me out. You just don't know. We want to live forever, but the reality is that sometimes tragedy besets us. What do people need to be minding with their money matters?
Well, typically I see one spouse or the other handles the money, paying the bills, doing the taxes, making the investments, and the other spouse is pretty happy to let them do that and really doesn't have a clue what they own, what they owe, where it's invested, how much their living expenses are, what their spouse even makes in salary sometimes. So, you know, people come to me in a wide variety. Some are pretty on top of it and pretty savvy. But I do see a pattern in marriages that one spouse tends to be the one who runs the show, knows where every dollar is, and the other one has no clue. And that's a danger zone as well. I mean, you know, we go back to the first point that I made of start with a strong foundation. Well, that foundation has to continue through. And that means communicating about money, understanding the family finances, having those similar goals. It all goes back to the same thing. And that means minding your money matters. You need to know what's coming in, what's going out, where it's invested, what it's doing for you, what kind of a state plan you have in place for those unfortunate events that might happen. It's very important that both spouses are a part of things, and that will keep you out of a lot of trouble.
And that's very good advice. Now, you have a project coming up that I'd like for you to share with us in the last few minutes that we have together. I can't believe we've burned up our whole segment already. Let's talk about briefly what you have going on coming up for folks.
Well, I am in the process of building a new website, and this will be a roadmap of sorts to help people understand their options and all the things that are associated with going through divorce and what kind of team members you need to have, and just giving people a snapshot of the issues around divorce. I also will be creating a line of information products, and this is called, my entire program is called The Secrets to a Sane, Savvy, Money-Saving Divorce, and the program will be sold in snippets. You can buy appetizers, you can buy meals, you can buy the full program. Is going to be done in a restaurant type concept, and that will be coming out soon. And right now, anyone who is interested in learning more can go to SaveMoneyInDivorce.com, and they will get a copy of the lawyer questions that I mentioned in the beginning. And they'll also be on the list that will give them more information when this program comes out. I will be also offering a group coaching component to this for people who want to get their plan in place and know what they need to know so they can go find someone in their state who I can help them find someone in their particular state that deals with these matters and start off on the right foot and save a whole heck of a lot of money in the process. So I'm pretty excited about this.
I am, too, because, you know, attorneys only know about laws. They have no idea what the ramifications are of unwinding certain financial instruments, especially retirement ones, that will have tax ramifications and things like that, or, you know, potential, you know, employment ramifications. Some employers won't let you dig around in their 401ks and pension plans, and when you start doing that and creating problems, you know, for one party, the employer could say, just, you know what, we're just going to let you go and then take your money with you and you figure out what you want to do with it. So it's dangerous when you let, you know, attorneys op on their own when they're not, you know, financial analysts themselves or financial planners. And, you know, estate planning attorneys have their value too, but when it comes to unraveling the financial aspects of divorce, it's so great to have had a guest on like you, Lisa, to be able to talk about money matters when it comes to divorce and the things that people need to be aware of before they get going down that road, because it could be costly and it could jeopardize what their future plans and hopes and dreams are for themselves as well as for their children. So thanks so much for joining us. For those, again, that are interested in Lisa's worksheets and her attorney questions, all you have to do is surf over to SaveMoneyInDivorce.com, and if you're driving around and can't write that down, as always, we have show links from our guests on our website for the following week, so you'll be able to link through from our website at www.unlockyourwealth.com. Thank you so much for joining us. Stay tuned for more Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth coming up right after this.
Like, has your cell phone or iPod ever totally run out of battery before? Maybe you're somewhere without power, like fishing, camping, or the beach. Now you can have all the power you need. The K3 Charger by Kinesis Industries uses wind and sun to charge your devices anytime, day or night. Use the wind and sun to store up charging power or charge your device right on the spot. Available now for $99.95. at www.kinesisindustries.com. That's Kinesis, K-I-N-E-S-I-S, Industries.com. Like, go there, totally.
Hi, this is Melanie, and I'm part of Two for the Road USA. I'm the X from Boomer and X. I've been test driving cars for several years, but in the last 18 months, I found it difficult to get in and out of the test vehicles. I kept complaining the manufacturers didn't make the seats large enough until I realized it was me who was too large at 220 pounds. Thanks to the Duradori weight loss program, I lost 50 pounds. The Duradori program is physician-supervised, non-surgical, safe, and effective, and you can lose up to 5 to 10 pounds the first week and 15 to 20 in a month. I did. It controls hunger and trains your body to burn fat, all on an easy-to-follow regimen of exercise, hydration, and delicious, healthy eating. It is a three-phase program combining medication, nutrition, and exercise. This is an affordable program with counselors available at any time. I went from a size 20 to a size 10 in 7 months, and I feel like a different person. Check out my photos on twoforthroadusa.com. Click on Watch Melanie Lose Weight on Duradori. Call Duradori now at 480-661-9662.
Even in today's economy, I, Count Dracula, have had to foreclose on my castle. But because of Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio, I have not only reacquired my castle, but I have opened a resort for the undead. Tune in to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. She's the only one not trying to suck you dry.
Welcome back to the broadcast, everyone. You're listening to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio, and it is now time for our Millionaire Minute. In this segment, we will crawl into the heads of top millionaire thinkers and put out 60 seconds of tools you can incorporate into your life right now today. And when it comes to finance, father really does know best, according to Charles Buffington Jr. and his son, Charles Buffington III, who said his dad became a millionaire following simple principles. He listened to his advice and then did what he said, and it worked. He says that he and his wife were financially secure because they did exactly what his father said to do. So together they have written, "He said it, I did it." Lessons from my father on mastering personal finance. So the Buffingtons offer these 10 tips for maximizing your wealth and minimizing your debt. Number one, have a clear vision and strategy for your financial future. Remember that hope is not a strategy. Number two, give generously and wisely. Practice educated giving. Number three, keep score to know your true net worth and play aggressive offense by investing and aggressive defense by reducing and eliminating debt. Number four, live below your means. Number five, create a realistic budget. Budget equals income plan spending plus savings. Number six, start investing now and make it a habit to invest every month. Number seven, figure out a way to buy a home. Number eight, avoid debt at all costs. If you have debt, realize that it's costing you money and causing you unnecessary worry. When paying off debt, prioritize your payments, reducing the highest interest rate debt first. Number nine, keep good credit. Know your credit profile and take decisive action to improve it. And number 10, find multiple streams of income. Find investment vehicles such as 401ks, mutual funds, and bonds, or turn your passion or hobby into a small business. Opportunities are all around you. You just must open your eyes for your own streams of income. Now, fully and completely integrate these habits now. See yourself in this way. Look forward into the future and watch how differently people will respond to you. Imagine yourself with these successes already. Create some affirmations with these tools as well to reinforce what you have just integrated into your personality. And that's your Millionaire Minute. For an in-depth look at today's Millionaire Minute, join us on Tuesdays at 6:30 a.m. for our Millionaire Nuts and Bolts segment, where we break down all of these tips, tricks, tools, and information to help you become a millionaire. So join us on Tuesdays at 6:30 a.m. to start your day the millionaire way. Now, guess what time it is?
It's a need you gotta fill. It's news you gotta know. And news by the numbers is your favorite part of the show. Yeah!
Yes, folks, it's time again. Blair Cherrier will be bringing us the news by the numbers, which is this week's stock market report and any other kinds of information that affect our economy. Blair, welcome to the broadcast.
Hi, Heather. Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited to have you back in the saddle this week.
Thank you.
I hope all of the nursing stuff went well for you.
It did. It was a great week.
Outstanding. Well, now it's time to buckle down and get back to work. So what happened in the stock market this week?
Well, it was quite a week. The Dow and the S&P had their worst start of May ever. The Dow declined over 5.5% and the S&P retreated almost 6.5%. The five-day period also marked the Dow's biggest weekly point drop since October of 2008 and its biggest weekly percentage drop since the beginning of March of 2009. The sell in May and go away adage appeared to be in full force and was further helped by growing fears that Europe's debt crisis will bring global recovery to a halt. The Dow fell 140 points to just under 10,400 Friday, while the NASDAQ declined 64 points and the S&P lost about 17, bringing it to a little under 1,100. From the San Francisco Market Watch, four U.S. banks were closed by regulators Friday, bringing the number of bank failures in the year-to-date to 68. The Bank of Bonifay, Champlin, Town Bank of Arizona, and First Pacific Bank were all closed and will cost the deposit insurance fund over $210 million, the FDIC said. Wells Fargo said in a Securities and Exchange Commission filing Friday that they are being investigated by certain government entities over mortgage lending practices of its affiliates. The bank is currently the focus of several lawsuits alleging it steered customers into more costly mortgage products and that documents contain misleading statements. Wells Fargo said it is cooperating fully with the investigation. According to A&M report, the April jobless rate rose to just under 10%, but non-farm payrolls increased by a higher than expected 290,000. The employment numbers come a day after one of the most harrowing days ever in the markets, as the Dow on Thursday took that near 1,000-point plunge in a harrowing five-minute sell-off, apparently triggered by a breakdown in trading systems. The trend is now favorable. In the past 4 months, 573,000 jobs have been created, 84% of them in the private sector. Businesses starting to hire again marks a pleasant reversal after having shed about 8.5 million jobs during the recession. Although the unemployment rate rose to just under 10%, it is actually positive news. The jobless rate increased only because about 800,000 people decided April was a good time to start looking for work rather than remain discouraged about their prospects. Of those 800,000, 550,000 found work, while the other 250,000 joined the ranks of the officially unemployed. In the past 4 months, the household survey reports that over 1.5 million people have found jobs, which is the best four-month stretch for growth since 2000. And that is your news by the numbers, and I'm Blair Trigger.
Thank you so much for bringing us that information. We missed out without having you around. So we have so much more, especially your fabulous Keys to Riches coming up. But first, another word from these guys.
Stay tuned for the second half of Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio with the Keys to Riches, right after this.
Hi, this is Melanie, and I'm part of Two for the Road USA. I'm the X from Boomer and X. I've been test driving cars for several years, but in the last 18 months, I found it difficult to get in and out of the test vehicles. I kept complaining the manufacturers didn't make the seats large enough until I realized it was me who was too large at 220 pounds. Thanks to the Diradori weight loss program, I lost 50 pounds. The Diradori program is physician-supervised, non-surgical, safe, and effective, and you can lose up to 5 to 10 pounds the first week and 15 to 20 in a month. I did. It controls hunger and trains your body to burn fat, all on an easy-to-follow regimen of exercise, hydration, and delicious, healthy eating. It is a three-phase program combining medication, nutrition, and exercise. This is an affordable program with counselors available at any time. I went from a size 20 to a size 10 in 7 months, and I feel like a different person. Check out my photos on twofortheroadusa.com. Click on Watch Melanie Lose Weight on Diradori. Call Diradori now at 480-661-9662.
Like, has your cell phone or iPod ever totally run out of battery before? Maybe you're somewhere without power, like fishing, camping, or the beach. Now you can have all the power you need. The K-Free Charger by Kinesis Industries uses wind and sun to charge your devices anytime, day or night. Use the wind and sun to store up charging power, or charge your device right on the spot. Available now! For $99.95 at www.kinesisindustries.com. That's Kinesis, K-I-N-E-S-I-S, industries.com. Like, go there, totally!
Listen, folks, we talked a lot about money on this project, but we haven't talked about how crazy and how obsessed today's culture has gotten about money. So I would like to end this project with a warning. I'd like you to be careful. Be careful. Be careful not to love money. You need to know the truth about money. And the truth is, money's a tool to be used, not a god to be worshipped. Be careful not to love it, because it isn't worth it to give up life and family for it. Don't even bother. There's just too many things worth more than the dollar. It's a tool to be used, not a god to be worshipped.
Be careful not to love it, because it isn't worth it to give up. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, the Keys to Riches is a baker's dozen of financial concepts that not only teach you how to think like the rich and be in control of your own money, but it also gives you specific techniques to create or fix your credit, reduce debt, save and invest, building wealth through real estate, all while transforming your current financial habits into healthy money management skills. And this week's key is hope for the best, plan for the worst. And I know that those of you who have been following along diligently try to take me to task on this one from the NLP, Neuro-Linguistic Programming, home front. But because we're precisely focusing on what we should be focusing on, our plan A, what happens is if we don't have a plan B and we get knocked off course by some catastrophic or life-changing event and we haven't thought about plan B, we have no way to address it, especially in a rational, non-emotional state. We have no way to address it. We have no way to focus and create options because more than likely we're out of options at this point. So how this benefits us is knowing that things can go one way or another, and because there's multiple outcomes, we have to be able to respond in multiple ways. And the value in calculating or preparing a potential response gives us options. And when we are not emotionally engaged from the trauma of a life-changing event or a catastrophic event, we can have more options and we will be in a more creative place to employ possibilities versus discounting them. Oh, that won't work, that won't work, because we're caught up in the emotion. And if you remember weeks ago, for those of you who are regular listeners, we talked about the area between stimulus and response. And in that area between stimulus and response, there's a space. And if we have already prepared possible alternatives for the outcomes that may beset us, then we can merely choose in that space to pursue one of those options we created. But having no options may trigger that fight or flight response that we always talk about, that chemical dump. And when that chemical dump occurs, there goes all of our rational thought and cognitive thinking. And we are now in our instinctual reactionary mode, as opposed to being in a responsible responding mode. We're in a reactionary mode. Being in a reactionary mode, we're either going to attack or we're going to run away. And most of us hate confrontation. I haven't really met a person that actually looks forward to confrontation and accepts challenges head on, unless they're one of my motivational speaker friends, where they have contemplated what their plan B is. So they're prepared. They have scenarios. They have outcomes that they have been able to generate as possibilities or alternatives to whatever stress occurs. So the key is, how do we stay resourceful? Well, in times that are good, we can be resourceful by being able to focus objectively when we're not emotional and be able to come up with all of these great alternatives for ourselves. And I always think about an interview that was given years ago, and it was part of a joke, but there was some validity into it. It evolved into a joke on the internet. And I'm talking like 10 or 15 years ago when I remember seeing this. And a woman was, an anti-gun woman, was interviewing a military professional and was talking about teaching our kids about the safe handling of guns. And she was kind of trying to pigeonhole him into saying that, no, it's not a good thing to train for that. But he wasn't going to give in. And he insisted that there was value in preparation and training, even though you may never actually fire a weapon in self-defense. Because you would, you know, that's your last resort, not your first option. It's your last option after you've tried to negotiate and mitigate circumstances when an event escalates, and you do your best to de-escalate the event. And then if your only resource is to use a weapon, then you would want to be trained on that. And I think her point was, you know, you shouldn't teach kids about a gun because then they'll go out and use them and get hurt and use them inappropriately. And he stuck to his position by saying that we do not rise to the occasion in emergency situations. We do not rise to the occasion. What we do is default to our training. Think about how powerful that is. We default to our training. So if we don't rise to the occasion and we default to our training, that begs the point of having a plan B. What is the alternative scenario? What are other options you can use to effectively handle this catastrophic or life-changing event? It's a powerful place to operate from. Think about anything that you do that's automatic. Remember the first time you got behind the wheel of a car, how scary it was? Maybe you weren't so lucky. Maybe you crashed. Maybe you, whatever, took out a few mailboxes along your street. And every time you got in the car, you were nervous. And you hoped it went okay. But you kept driving, you kept practicing and learning until now you can pick up the phone, you can yap on the phone, adjust your radio player, drive, load kids in and out of the car, all of these things we do on autopilot. So if something happened and you had to hop into a car and race to the hospital for you or someone you love, and you didn't know how to drive, how would that work out for you? Would you just freak out and not drive? Or would you try to drive but not be good at it? What happens is, if you didn't know how to drive, you're going to get stuck in that fight or flight response. Your chemical dump is going to occur and your brain is going to get shut off. But if you know how to drive, it's not going to be difficult to grab your kid off the playing field after he's broken his arm or leg, run him to the car, throw him in the car, or place him there gently, I guess I should say, and race to the hospital to get them put back together. That's easy. That's automatic. When you went to that game, were you there to watch them win the game? Or at least play the game? Or were you there to have them get their leg broke or arm broke and race them to the hospital? No. You weren't there for that reason. You were there, hope for the best, to go watch them win. But had you not known how to drive, you may not have been able to deliver them to the hospital, so it might have postponed their healing. Or they might not have fared so lucky. You know, you just don't know what's going to happen. But the fact that you know how to drive helps you get there. You're not focusing on your driving skills, okay, by learning how to drive. Once you got it into place, it's good. It just hangs out in the background. You're still focusing on plan A. My child's going to play a great game. So the point of focusing not on the negative, but on how do I handle different options. You know, one of the precursors or presuppositions of neurolinguistic programming is I never see failure as failure, only as feedback. So if you have a plan B, it's not that you're not focusing on plan A. But if plan A gives you some feedback that you might need to do it another way, wouldn't it be great if we had a plan B? So my point is, you're just creating options. But if you do not create options, and you're only hoping for the best, what happens when your hope doesn't come out so good? Then what are you going to do? Again, the time to decide what you're going to do when plan A doesn't work is not when plan A is not working. The time to plan for plan B is while plan A is chugging along swimmingly. It's famously moving forward. And that way you can be objective about logical options that may not seem so logical when you're in the moment, but because you're not engaged emotionally in the situation, you can be articulate and effective this way. I love this week's Millionaire Minute and how the father said, hope is not a strategy. I love that because I have someone that tells me, well, I hope all the time. And I'm like, well, what does that exactly mean? And so now I have a more appropriate response. And now I can say, hope is not a strategy. So what is the strategy? Now I have something to focus on. It was such a stroke of genius and so brilliant for me. And I thought, you know what? I love this show because in the research of this show, trying to create great things for you to listen to, I am receiving gems myself. So I was pretty excited about that moment. So we're going to hope for the best, and we're going to remember that hope is not a strategy. So we're going to plan for the worst. And what could be the worst for you financially? Let's talk about some of those things that could be devastating for you financially. One, you could lose your job. That'd be pretty devastating financially. You could be sued by another party and lose and owe a bunch of money. You could be in a relationship with a significant other, and maybe that significant other is displaced. What if a catastrophic event occurred where you survived, but in some way you were impaired and your ability to make money is gone forever? How do you handle that? If your ability to earn income is impaired forever, it might be too late once it happens to try to figure out what you're going to do. It begs the importance of having an alternative scenario. And I'd have a few. Because it could, you know, not just be something simple like you need to replace your car, got totaled in a car collision. It could be, you know, oh, well, my spouse lost a job, but they can go get another one, and I'm still working, so it's not so bad. What happens if the worst happens? Not that you pass away, but that you survive and are impaired physically, mentally, both. What happens? How do you provide for yourself? How do you provide for your family? And this is why our knowledge is power, not knowing is powerful key is so important in that knowledge checklist that we talked about. Because there are things that you don't know you need to know in this lifetime to survive and thrive financially. And what you don't know, you either need to learn or delegate. And if you're not properly insured or properly invested, when you get to this point, hope for the best, plan for the worst, you could be SOL. So what we talk about is how do we create a tiered plan of action? How do we create our own safety net while we're accumulating wealth that in itself isn't financially devastating to us and can go away if we don't need it, but if we do need it, it's in place. So what do we need to know about our finances? Well, one, if you get injured on the job, depending on who you're working for, you may or may not have a workman's compensation claim. That will cover you for part of the time. But what happens during that period of time that you're not covered? Workman's comp doesn't replace the very next paycheck. You have to prove there's an issue. You have to file all this paperwork. It's a long, drawn-out thing. I know I had to do this in my previous marriage. So I understand what's involved in filing for workman's compensation when you have someone who's injured. It does not kick in for up to 4 months. So what are you going to do when you're injured and you have still have bills to pay, but you don't have 4 months of income coming in? This is where your value of having an emergency fund of a minimum of 3, but most comfortable, 6 months' worth of living expenses set aside in the bank. Many Americans spend 92% of their income servicing debt, malarkey debt, full of bull debt, debt for stuff that they couldn't wait and save up for, that they had to have now, and they're paying off in minimum payments, one payment at a time, and because they needed to be instantly gratified, and they didn't realize that they couldn't afford that particular thing because their desire and the media through marketing told them that they deserved it, whether or not they earned it. So they're servicing all of this debt on crap that they no longer even maybe have, that expensive pair of designer sunglasses that got broke. You're still paying for it because you spent $500 for that pair on your credit. So you don't have your credit. So you don't have available credit to live off of. And not like that's a viable option. You should have an emergency fund set into place, a given. All right? Now, we always talk about, when we talk about no seasonal exceptions, we talk about seasonal expenditures. Okay? We got Mother's Day this Sunday. Mother's Day always comes around the same time every year. Same with Easter, your birthday, religious holidays, always the same time every year. Graduation is coming up. And with graduation, you have no excuse because your minimum time is 18 years to save for a graduation present. 16 or 17 if they're smarty pants and get out early. That's enough lead time to buy a graduation present, I would guess. You send them off to college, they graduate from college. Well, you got another 4 years or possibly more if they're going for a doctor's or an attorney's degree or something like that. So those aren't viable options. So we got to have our emergency fund in place, and then we have to buffer that with another tier of savings, and that's for quality of life. So that's for all of those expenditures that we know we're going to have, but we're not going to have them today, when we can start saving a little bit at a time for them. This does not include your retirement, and this does not include your child's college education, especially if you don't already have your own retirement figured out and set in motion. But this is quality of life savings. You and your spouse want to renew your vows and do a second honeymoon and go, do something extravagant or you want to build that pool, instead of tacking it onto the mortgage, you actually save up and pay cash for that pool for your house. So these are the things that we must be thinking about. Now, in addition to having these cash reserves available, for other catastrophic life-changing events, you must have insurance. Insurance isn't for rich people. It's for the people who want to be rich. And it covers the gap between what you have now and where you need to be self-insured, financially independent, where you're beholden to no one. So if your family has chronic health problems, it's probably a good idea to go out and get some health insurance. And if you have a lot of extenuating factors, pick and choose your coverage to make it affordable. But there's no reason why your child shouldn't have regular medication that they need from a mysterious diagnosis yesterday, because it was more important for you to have a widescreen 3D television instead of providing health insurance for your family. If you're servicing debt on malarkey things like that, and you're doing that but not paying for health insurance and saying you can't afford health insurance, your priorities are screwed up, and I'll be the first one to tell you that. You have to get your priorities straight, and you have to understand what's important for you. And if your family is as important as you say it is, because I hear people all the time tell me how important their family is, but their actions speak louder than words. They say one thing and they do another, and they're not congruent. If your family is important to you, you must figure out what's going to happen in the worst of times. It's easy to figure out how to spend money in the best of times. How do we survive the worst of times and weather the storm until we can get to those best of times? So you must have emergency fund. And I'm not even going to say the number three anymore. I'm going to say 6 months' worth of income. So if you make $2,000 a month times six, that's $12,000 you need to have in the bank, ready at a moment's notice for any catastrophic event. How does it get to $12,000? I'll tell you, $1 at a time, 50 cents at a time, 25 cents at a time, whatever spare change you have in your pocket at a time. Don't make excuses of why you can't get to $12,000, because it's like eating elephant, and you do it one bite at a time. You're going to save one unit of monetary measurement at a time, whether it be a quarter, a dime, a nickel, a penny, a dollar. It doesn't matter. Get started today. Even if you're servicing debt, you must have an emergency fund set up, because if you never set it up while you're trying to whittle down this debt, and then the debt goes nowhere, and now you're stuck where you don't have any more income coming in, and you still have no emergency fund, how are you going to service all that debt? Don't tell me about saving money here and there and the difference in interest and blah, blah, blah. At the end of the day, the only way to break the cycle, the bad debt cycle, is to have cash on hand available at a moment's notice. So you must set aside your emergency fund. Once you're properly insured and your emergency fund is in place, then and only then start saving for these quality of life items, these extended gifting periods like birthdays, holidays, stuff that doesn't occur. Like, it's not like you don't know when your birthday is every year. It's not like you don't know when Mother's Day and Father's Day are every year, because it's at the same time. I guarantee you kids don't forget when Christmas is. So knowing that, after you set aside the first two layers, your emergency fund and proper insurance, then you can go to quality of life savings. And we don't finance our big screen TVs. We save up for them and we pay cash for them if that's what we truly want. And then we build our retirement, because that's long term. That's way out there. We don't want to work and then get at the end of the road and want to take a break and then not have a big pile of money to live off of. And the sooner you start, you get the rule of 72 working in your favor and the power of compound interest. And to be a millionaire doesn't mean you have to save a million. You don't even have to save half a million. You would be shocked at the number you have to put away every month to become a millionaire and retire wealthy. And remember, we're living longer these days. So we're going to either have to work longer or have more money to last that period of time. And that's your tiered program. Now, there are specifics to it. So if you would like to receive a playbook, a sheet out of the playbook for how to create this for yourself, how to estimate appropriately for your family what you need, just email us here at the show. Just drop us an email for hotsheet@unlockyourwealth.com, hotsheet@unlockyourwealth.com, and we will get you that play sheet so you can figure out what it is that you need to get where you want to go and make sure that you have properly prepared for yourself in the meantime. So y'all ready for nuts and bolts? Our key statement for this week is, while my efforts and energies must be focused on my plan A, I can prepare an alternative course of action for those unexpected life events. I can and must prepare for those unexpected life events. Our key affirmation for this week is, I am great at preparing my tiered plan of action. I am great at preparing my tiered plan of action. Now, for those of you who are joining us for the first time, we do our affirmations several times throughout the day because what we think about, we bring about, and we want to be focused on positive things because the brain is the greatest superhuman computer of the universe, and it succeeds always, every time. You just have to be careful on how you program it. And that's why we focus on so many positive things. So the first time you say your affirmation is right before you go to bed. You pull out your list of affirmations and you want to add this one to it, or if you haven't even started, now is your first affirmation for your affirmation list. And then right before you go to bed at night, out loud to yourself, read these affirmations so you can hear them and begin to internalize them. And what that does is that sets up your subconscious mind to work diligently throughout the night while you're receiving restful, restorative sleep, to create options and scenarios for you in order to accomplish whatever it is that you desire, hence the creative part. And so while you are getting this restful, restorative sleep, your brain is creating new neural pathways to bring your affirmation into fruition. And then the next time we say our affirmation is first thing in the morning, don't roll over and kiss the spouse. Don't get up and let the dog out. You're going to roll over, you're going to grab your affirmations, you're not even going to brush your teeth, and you're going to say these out loud to yourself once again, because now what we're doing is we're setting up our conscious mind to be focused on our higher purpose of the day. And that is truly what's important in your life, but it isn't always what we get focused on, because then we have to get the kids fed and dressed and off to school and the husband to work, and then we have to go drop off dry cleaning and, oh, by the way, get to our own job and then figure out how we're shuffling the kids back and forth to soccer and all that good stuff. And so then the next time we're going to say our affirmations is, anytime we encounter negativity throughout the day, whether it be from a spouse, a coworker, a parent, a child, a subordinate, an employer, who knows, after you have that negative encounter, you're going to pull out your affirmations again to make sure that you're refocused on your higher purpose for the day, because what you think about, you bring about. Our key action item for this week is to begin thinking about what the alternative scenarios might be if plan A doesn't work out, and start preparing for emergencies. Set up your tiered preparedness plan of action. Have appropriate insurances in place and keep your personal and non-investment debts to a minimum, and then start saving for your financial future, and it begins with your emergency fund. Thanks so much for everybody who participated in the show. Blair, for moderating the chat room, tweeting up a storm, and doing news by the numbers. Also, Lisa Decker, who taught us all about divorce financially. And next week, we've got yet an even better show in store for you. But remember, we've got Millionaire Nuts and Bolts from Unlock Your Wealth Radio on Tuesday mornings at 6:30 a.m. Wake up and start your day the millionaire way. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Heather Wagenhals. You're listening to Heather Wagenhals Unlock Your Wealth Radio. Here's to your financial independence.
I've had it up to here, listening to a small segment of people trying to put down America. America's the greatest land on earth, and we ought to be proud of what we have. I'm proud of America. I'm proud of our people, and I'm going to prove it. We're American and damn proud of it.
Frankly, I'm getting a little ticked off.
Go to hell.